Hi, welcome to The Good Robot Andy's Season 1, Episode 4. I am Andy Balaam, and this is...
Andy Cockerill.
And today, the film we are talking about is...
Interstellar.
And I know a bit too much about this film to make up its plot based purely on its title. But I did think that it's kind of like a modern-day Quantum Leap. Is that right?
Did you say Quantum Leap?
Quantum Leap.
Okay.
Is that approximately right?
Pardon?
Is that approximately right?
What, that it's like Quantum Leap?
Yes.
No, not really.
Oh, dear. Right, should we start with some correspondence? I just realised we should be
Yes,
doing?
Yes, let's do that. Yeah.
Okay, let's grab
We actually have some this week.
Okay. I'll just bring it up. Okay, so here are our comments, yeah. Okay, so comment from Farsi, saying he really liked Nightcrawler, liked the look and feel of it, likes Jake Gyllenhaal and thinks that he's generally very good. And talked about a very... there's loads of noise coming from you, Andy.
Is that from me?
Well, I think so.
I think that's somebody upstairs.
Crashing and banging.
Let me turn my gain down a bit. How's that? Is that better? Can you still hear me?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Okay.
That may be the disadvantage of the desk mic.
I think it might be, but let's
crack on.
Yeah.
Okay. And he's talking about one particular uncomfortable moment in the film about Bloom forcing a date with Nina.
Yeah, no, I forgot to talk about that. There's he has a date with her, and then he asks her quite forcibly if she'll have sex with him, which she is not very keen on. But it is probably at that point that we realise that he is out to get, you know, as much as he can out of this relationship that he has with her.
Mm-hmm. And we don't really like him.
No. No.
He also mentions Natural Born Killers. He says he doesn't think it stood the test of time, which I think is probably how I feel as well. That. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that may be why when I went back to watch it recently, I just couldn't get into it. It's... I think that Natural Born Killers has had its time, and that there have been other better films about that kind of subject matter since then that have kind of eclipsed it.
Right, yeah. Yeah. He also says, yeah, like Nightcrawler, looks like it's possibly intentionally hard to work out what time period it's set in, and that it's very cheaply made.
Yeah, that was interesting. Although that does actually make a lot of sense, because thinking about the aesthetic of it, it does look as if they've shot using actual lighting and very little in the way of film lighting. And most of it's shot at night, so you know, you don't need to worry about the weather during the day and stuff like that. You can just get on and shoot as much as you want. So, yeah, I can see that it probably is cheaply made. Mm. But it doesn't look... cheaply made, you know, it looks really good.
Yeah, you were saying it was slick, yeah, that's
yeah, very, cool. Very, very slick.
Cool, that's it for feedback this week.
Okay.
So tell me a bit about Interstellar. I should point out, I haven't seen it, I've just heard about it, so I still need to have it properly explained to me, please.
Okay, so I'll tell you what, I'm going to read you the IMDb synopsis, which is very brief. Which is, a team of explorers travel through a wormhole in space in an attempt to ensure humanity's survival. So, that's it.
That's potted.
Yeah, that's a potted synopsis. So it's directed by Christopher Nolan, who made Inception and... The Dark Knight trilogy.
Yeah,
and
Take or Leave It.
I like the middle one. I like the middle one of the Dark Knight trilogy until the game theory bit, and then I think, okay.
That's probably the only bit I liked.
You only like the game theory bit at the end.
I don't remember the game theory bit. With the boats.
The boats.
Oh, it's so annoying.
Yeah. It's so annoying. He also made The Prestige with Christian Bale. And
speaking of films that have scarred me. You know, we were talking about that last time or the time before. Yeah, that film has... I think it has scarred me. I don't know whether in a good way or a bad way, but yeah, I still vividly remember it.
You didn't like it?
No, I wouldn't say I didn't like it or did like it, but I just felt traumatised by it.
Okay. He also made a remake of a Swedish movie called Insomnia, with Robin Williams and Al Pacino.
I thought that was made by the person that made the Backwards film.
The Backwards film? Memento?
Yeah.
Yes, but that's Christopher Nolan.
Oh, that's Christopher Nolan?
Yes.
I didn't realise those were the same people.
He also made Memento. That was his proper debut feature film.
Yeah, I thought Memento was great. I thought Insomnia was very boring and I didn't like it.
Yeah, to be fair, I've seen the original Swedish language version and it isn't actually that much better. So
so your question, why would you remake it?
Yes, exactly. So it's directed by Christopher Nolan. It's written by Christopher Nolan and Jonathan Nolan, who is his brother, who's his sort of frequent collaborator. And it stars Matthew McConaughey, who is going through at the moment what I think a film journalist coined as McConaissance in his career.
What's that?
What it means is that he has been famous for some time for doing ropey rom-coms, Matthew McConaughey. But there was a time when he was really cool and he did a lot of really good stuff. But sort of like probably 5 years ago, he was famous for being in some bad rom-coms. And then he turned it all around.
Can you name some of the good stuff he was in before the bad stuff?
Before the bad stuff. So he was in Contact with Jodie Foster.
Oh, yeah, which I don't think I've seen.
Okay, so he's very good in that.
Right.
He plays a sort of lay preacher who has to sort of reconcile the science with his beliefs.
Right.
Which is quite interesting. He was in, many, many years ago, Dazed and Confused. Dazed and Confused. Richard Linklater's Dazed and Confused, which also has early performances by Ben Affleck as well, when he was very so young that you can't actually believe that it's Ben Affleck. You know when these actors are just so young and they just...
Yeah.
You sit there looking at him thinking, is that really Ben Affleck? Yeah, so he's been in some very good stuff indeed. When it was announced that he would be in Interstellar, I was a bit sceptical, to be honest, because he has done some bad stuff, but in Interstellar, he brings the sort of spirit of Chuck Yeager, you know, sort of test pilot, American test pilot,
mm-hmm.
wrote the speed of sound.
Barrier.
Sound barrier. Who broke the sound barrier, yes. He sort of evokes that pioneer spirit, that kind of let's just go and do it kind of attitude. So
mm-hmm.
Matthew McConaughey.
Is he Anne the star? Hathaway,
pardon?
Is he the star?
Not really. No, I mean he is an important character in it, but there are other important characters that he shares billing with. So
okay.
There's him, there's Anne Hathaway. Who was in the most recent Dark Knight,
and
Dark Knight Rises.
Famously married to William Shakespeare.
Yes, that's right. Amazing that she's still around and looking quite good on it, really.
She's had a lot of work.
Yeah, a lot of work. Jessica Chastain, who is sort of very, very, very serious-minded actress. She plays Matthew McConaughey's daughter for reasons that I will explain later.
Is that a spoiler?
It is.
Should we warn our listeners?
But this is a spoilery podcast.
Listeners, so it's okay. There will be spoilers. You have been warned.
Sir Michael Caine, isn't it? I think he's in most of Christopher Nolan's movies. He plays Anne Hathaway's father. He's a scientist, a physicist.
He was surprisingly good in Batman.
I thought he was very good in that, actually.
Yeah, probably one of the best things about it.
Yeah, I think particularly in the second one, he is an emotional heart for it, isn't he?
Yeah.
And some of his very, very well-written dialogue about how do you deal with a madman who just doesn't care about money or anything like that is very powerfully done. So he's in it. The IMDb synopsis is technically correct, but there is more to it. There's a lot more to it than that. So the situation at the beginning of the film is that there's a crop blight in planet Earth, and
okay,
essentially
it's a bit like Children of Men but with plants.
Yeah. So yeah, the environment is slowly withering away, and people can't grow wheat anymore, and they're turning to corn to sort of. Mm-hmm. For the answer, and that's slowly dying off as well. And
that's already an interesting idea. I already feel more positive about it than I did when we started.
And it looks, visually, it looks really stunning. So there's massive dust storms where Matthew McConaughey lives with his family in the Midwest. His wife has died sometime in the past, and he brings up his two children. There's Murphy, there's his daughter, young daughter, and his son. And they also have there's a granddad. Sorry, I forgot about the granddad, who's played by the brilliant John Lithgow.
Who's that?
Did you ever watch a TV sitcom called Third Rock from the Sun?
No, I'm aware of it. I don't think I watched it.
Okay, so he played the sort of lead alien in that. He's a very, mm-hmm. very, very, very good actor indeed. So mm-hmm. He plays Matthew. I'm not sure whether he's his father or whether he's his deceased wife's dad. But anyway, he's granddad, and he helps bring up the kids and sort of look after the farm and that kind of thing. And his daughter thinks that she's got a poltergeist in her room.
Okay. Because
books keep falling off the shelves.
It's going all M. Night Shyamalan.
Yeah. So, well, no, not really. So she thinks she's got a poltergeist. And then there's weird things happening with gravity, with gravitational fields near this farm. So there's a scene in where there's loads of these automated combine harvesters. That all of their GPS gets screwed up, and they all end up converging on the farm and surrounding it, and nobody can figure out why this is happening.
That is a bit M. Night Shyamalan.
Yeah, it's very effective.
I also just mention, since you used the word gravity, that I liked the film Gravity.
I really like Gravity. Really, we should probably talk about that in a future podcast. Actually,
yeah.
And that would be one we can talk about because we've both seen it.
Yeah, we should ruin it, so I'll pretend that I haven't.
Yeah, I really like Gravity. I think, to digress briefly from Interstellar, I think that Gravity is a B-movie with a massive budget. It's got one idea. You know, it's the kind of thing that would have been made in the 1980s on a shoestring budget, and it would have been rubbish.
But it's the way he does action sequences with...
They're so good.
With no sound...
Yeah.
Oh, amazing.
So we'll come to that, actually. And later in Interstellar, there's an example of an action sequence with no sound that's very effective. So Gravity is behaving strangely at this farm. And then Cooper, which is the name of Matthew McConaughey's character. That's his surname.
Ask a question. They are aware, these filmmakers, that GPS doesn't work by gravity.
Say that again.
They are aware that GPS doesn't work by gravity, aren't they?
Yes.
Okay, just checking.
Yeah. So, but they don't actually know what's going on with these combine harvesters. They just think the GPS is messed up.
Uh-huh.
He then figures out that the books that are falling off the shelves are making a pattern on the floor.
Like a crop circle?
Yeah, kind of. Not really, no. It's sort of like a kind of binary type code.
Hmm. It's like localized, massive localized gravity fluctuations.
Yeah.
But all of their internal organs are still intact.
All of them are, yes. This code is actually coordinates.
Okay.
And he writes them down and looks it on the map and he figures out where it is. And he takes Murphy, his daughter, and they go off and look for these coordinates to see what the heck is going on.
So they're like coordinates on Earth?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So they go in a truck. They go in their truck. And when they get there, it's an abandoned NORAD installation. And he gets stunned by a security guard, shocked by a security guard, and then wakes up. And there's Sir Michael Caine. And it's actually, what it is a secret NASA base.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to figure out how to save the human race. Because what they've discovered near Saturn is a wormhole. And this is where we get to the interesting stuff to do with the sort of physics and the science of
a tiny, tiny, tiny wormhole.
Pardon?
A tiny, tiny wormhole. Right? Not one that's, say, the size of, 17 stars or...
No, exactly, yes. It's in the film, it's portrayed as looking like... you see those zero-G shots of astronauts with water?
Yeah.
It's like that. It's like a bubble of water. Or like, actually, it's like a bubble that you blow when you blow bubbles, and you can see colours on the surface and things like that.
Right. And isn't that one of the bits of it that's supposed to be really scientifically accurate, and they built this great simulation to make that effect?
Yeah. So just they've discovered this wormhole, and they've sent astronauts through this wormhole with spacecraft to see if they can find habitable planets on the other side. And they've had interesting data back from like three of these astronauts. And they want to send a larger ship through with a bigger crew to see what they can find.
Mm-hmm. And because this guy and his daughter stumbled across this this center in a truck, they're adequately qualified to fly a spaceship through a wormhole.
Okay, so Cooper, I completely forgot to mention this at the top of the podcast. Cooper is a former NASA test pilot.
Uh-huh. Making him slightly more qualified than just some bloke in a
truck. So this is what I was talking about at the top. I was talking about this at the top, is that he's a Chuck Yeager type. He's an old-school NASA test pilot. And they need him. They need his old-school skills for, this seat-of-the-pants mission that's basically, they're betting the farm on it. They haven't got anything else up their sleeve now.
Right.
So Michael Caine is there. He plays a scientist. I'm just looking up his name because I'm lazy. He's quite a long way down the billing. Professor Brand, that's it. And his daughter in the movie is Anne Hathaway.
Mm-hmm.
She is on the mission along with two other scientists and also a robot. But not a robot not a humanoid-looking robot.
Okay.
This is a robot that looks like a piece of not a piece of 2x4 wood, but it's sort of shaped like a piece of 2x4, and it's smooth, just a smooth block basically of metal that can move around.
Does it hover?
Pardon?
Does it hover?
No, doesn't do any hovering. It only walks. It can walk around, and it has built-in settings for sarcasm and honesty and things like that. And it's very, very cleverly voiced.
Uh-huh.
So it makes you laugh. The robot is funny.
Really? Okay. That's a real surprise. I thought that doesn't fit with what I was expecting. I thought this was a bit more, going to be more serious.
Well, it is, but the robot provides light relief when it's required. Well, I don't mean it's funny in a sort of Jar Jar Binks kind of way. Or a C-3PO kind of way.
I'm now thinking of, is it the film The Black Hole with the funny robot?
No, it's
That's
not
a Disney film, isn't it? Right?
Yes. Yeah. But it's such a weird movie, The Black Hole, isn't it?
Yeah, I like it.
It's such a weird film. So they travel to Saturn in their beautiful spacecraft.
So what they're doing is someone has seen a planet that looks possibly habitable, so they're going to go and habitate it.
They've got three. They've had three sets of feedback from the other side,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to go and try and check them all out if they can, to see what's habitable.
Okay, is this like a one-way mission?
No, they can come and go through the wormhole.
Okay, all right. So is his daughter going to come with him?
Yes.
Yeah, so this is what I'm wondering about. Why, if it's not a one-way mission, why is his daughter coming with him?
Sorry, no. Murphy, the young daughter,
yeah,
is staying at home.
Okay, right. It felt to me like she was going to come. But anyway, okay, go on.
So she is understandably pretty upset about this. And that's where I was talking last week. Actually, I don't know if we recorded this, but I think we spoke about this, and I was saying that I think that Interstellar has a big heart. You know,
it
wears its big heart on its sleeve, and it's unashamedly does that.
Yeah, I don't think that was on the recording. But yeah.
Okay, so I think Christopher Nolan has been, in the past, a somewhat cold, somewhat Kubrickian, like a Stanley Kubrick kind of quite manipulative, quite logically minded kind of director.
Mm-hmm.
And Interstellar kind of skews that, because the relationship between Cooper and Murphy is really powerful and strong.
Mm-hmm.
And when he says he's going to be leaving, she is really upset about that.
Right.
And when she gets upset about it in her bedroom, more stuff falls off the bookshelves.
Okay.
Yeah. So
she's in contact with the aliens through her bookshelves.
So yes, they leave the Earth. They go in this spaceship that looks, what is it like? It's one of these things that revolves. It spins to give you artificial gravity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's different pods, a bit like the International Space Station.
It's quite big then.
Yes. Yeah, it's big. It's in orbit, so they get up there using a space shuttle like craft, and then they transfer over to this un-aerodynamically sound spacecraft, and off they go towards Saturn. And they pass through the wormhole, which is rather beautiful. It's this spherical object where you can see inside galaxies and star systems. Mm.
Do they mention how it got there?
No.
There's not like a few black holes around it.
It just appeared. So I'll go into that in a moment. But as they're passing through the wormhole, Brand, the Anne Hathaway character, Sir Michael Caine's daughter, she sees what looks like a spectral hand coming through the hull of the ship.
Okay.
Trying to touch her.
Just as a slight diversion.
Yes.
There are a lot of spacey type films where weird stuff happens. You know, 2001, yes. Moon. Yeah, a lot of things where there's this feeling that, Solaris, which I really liked.
Is that the Steven Soderbergh remake of Solaris with George Clooney?
Yes, I may have seen both. I may have only
seen
that.
I haven't seen the older one, the 1970s one, but I really liked the George Clooney one. I thought it was really good.
Yeah, there's this feeling that somehow if we just get far enough out into space, really weird stuff's going to happen. Anyway, do go on.
Yeah, it's almost like you get away from a solar system and you get into deep space and the laws of physics kind of just look the other way and I think there's strange stuff going on. So she sees this hand coming through the hull of the spacecraft, like a spectral hand. But she can't really identify, you know, what that was all about or whether it was a hallucination or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So they get through the wormhole and they are now in not very close proximity to a supermassive black hole, which is called Gargantua.
Okay.
And this is where all of the planets in question are orbiting
Black hole. Wow. And presumably that might be some reason why the wormhole's there or something.
It might be.
Can I satisfy myself with that?
So to talk about the science of Interstellar, the consultant on this was a guy called Kip Thorne, who is a contemporary of Professor Stephen Hawking. And he is one of the scientists who has sort of brought about the theories about wormholes.
Mm-hmm.
And his theory is that a wormhole can only really be artificially made, i.e. made by humans or some kind of other intelligence, rather than being a naturally forming phenomena. Mm-hmm. So the fact that it just appeared one day is kind of consistent with it being created by an intelligence.
So we're beginning to become rather suspicious at this point, aren't we? Of external agents.
Yeah. So they make a choice about which planet to go for first, and they decide to go for a planet that is quite close to Gargantua. And what this means is that they will suffer some effects of Einstein's special theory of relativity, in that they will think that half an hour has passed when in fact many years may have passed back on the spacecraft and, of course, back on Earth as well.
All right, forget it. Go on.
Okay, so they go down to this planet and they're looking for the original spacecraft, that one of the probes, and they find it, but they discover that the astronaut is dead. And
is that because he's been absolutely and utterly torn limb from limb by the massive level of gravity required to have that kind of relativistic effect?
So there aren't. It would appear that according to Kip Thorne's theories. I was just reading about this before the podcast, is that these planets could quite comfortably exist near this supermassive black hole because it's not rotating that fast. So although it's very big, it's not exerting massive gravitational fields.
Okay. Well, if it's not exerting massive gravitational fields, then you wouldn't get those relativistic effects, though. Anyway, I'm going to just put it down now.
Yeah, but this particular planet is very close to it, so it is more affected than planets that are further away. So
still,
where was I?
Sorry,
that's all right. I'm just trying to think what. So they go down to this planet, which is it seems to be purely a water. Based planet, so there's no land masses anywhere.
Okay, but they find that they found the spaceship.
They found the spaceship. They found that the guy is dead,
mm-hmm.
and they realise that they're in trouble because on this planet there are these massive waves that are being caused by the black hole that threaten their lives. They lose a crew member in the process, and then they realise that they've been down there for longer than they should have been. They get back to the ship, and the crew member that they left on board is now grey-haired and bearded, and he's been putting himself into hypersleep, in and out of hypersleep, and they realise they've been in there for like 30, they've been away for 30 years. So Cooper immediately goes to the the lounge where they've got the recorder for sending messages to and from Earth, and he finds a whole stack of messages from Murphy. And the first one is that she's a grown woman now, and she's saying, you know, you said you were coming home and you never came. And then there's another message saying that Granddad is dead and all this kind of thing. And it you know, the weight of that on him is immense, you know, in terms of he's just completely missed his child growing up without even realizing it, because they put themselves in so much danger and they stayed on the planet for too long. So they have to make a have to make a quick decision now about which planet they're going to go to next. And it turns out that Brand, the Anne Hathaway character on board, has had a relationship with one of the other scientists who came through the wormhole first. And she wants to go to the planet where he is to find out if he's still alive. And Cooper makes a pragmatic, quite a tough decision that may be based on where he is sort of emotionally at the time, to say that, no, we're not going there. We're going to go to this other planet. Because I think you're making an emotional decision, and we need to be making logical decisions about, you know, the closest planet is going to be the best one.
This is all very, very painful.
Yeah. So she is, you know, this puts them, you know, emotionally at loggerheads, but professionally they sort of get on with the job. But it's, they realize now that the longer they stay out here, the more difficult it's going to get for them to get home to a family or people that they are actually still alive.
Yeah, presumably this this person she was having a relationship with on this planet is also 30 years older, or you know, has aged a lot.
Yeah, so she is yes, that is correct. Yeah, so he may well not be around by the time they actually get there.
Yeah, all kinds of events may have happened in the intervening period. They might have sent you another 100
ships. Yeah, a lot
has
happened.
Okay.
And one of the things, no other ships have come through.
Okay.
And one of the things that they find out via the recorder is that Brand, the, Professor Brand, the Michael Caine character, who said he was working on a theory to try and get as many people off the planet Earth as possible and through the wormhole. That was all a lie.
Okay.
He had no theory. This plan A was all there was.
Right.
So he basically lied to them to get them to go on the mission. And they find it. They discover this from Murphy, who tells them that, you know, she's not only has she basically lost her father, you know, she's basically now got no hope of ever seeing them again.
And Earth is busy dying.
Earth is busy dying in their absence, yeah, as far as they're concerned. Things have gotten a lot worse. So they go to this other planet, which is basically in deep freeze. It's, as far as they can tell, there's no liquid water anywhere on this planet. You know, it's incredibly cold. And they find the ship and they wake up the astronaut who's in there, who turns out to be Matt Damon.
Matt Damon.
Matt Damon. So, and he tells them that, you know, this, he's been putting himself in and out of hypersleep to try and, you know, he's waiting for them to turn up. And he says that, you know, this planet is viable, and they should, he then takes Cooper out quite a long way to show him what it's like.
Mm-hmm.
And then as this is going on, they use their robot to try and read his computer, to interface with his computer and get his records off there.
Oh, dear.
And they realise that it's all a lie.
Yeah.
And he's taken Cooper off to kill him and steal their ship.
Okay.
Because he's gone a bit mad. Yeah. He's gone a bit space crazy.
Yeah.
He's desperate to get back to Earth by any means. So he tries to kill Cooper, and he steals the ship. Anne Hathaway's brand rescues Cooper, and they manage to lock out the mothership's airlock so that he can't dock with it and escape. But he tries to initiate a manual docking procedure. And it's in this moment when I was talking about the silent action sequence.
Right.
In that he's in the airlock and he cannot manually dock it. It won't allow him to do it.
Mm-hmm. This is all a bit, I'm sorry, Dave, I can't do that.
It's very much like that, yeah, very much like that. So he's up at the mothership with the small lander, and they are following him in their other ship. And what you see is him trying to pass through the airlock without actually sealing it.
Right.
And as he decompresses, the whole thing just explodes silently. And you don't actually see what happens to him, but presumably it's quite nasty.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he's in a spacesuit, he couldn't have survived that sort of fast decompression.
Mm-hmm.
What that does is it causes obviously a massive decompression, an explosion that causes this mothership to start spinning uncontrollably towards the planet's surface.
Right.
And it's here that Murphy shows his skills as a pilot, because he gets their robot to match the spin of their ship with the spin of the mothership.
Mm-hmm.
He docks it, and then he corrects the spin with retros and manages to get it out of the atmosphere.
Sounds fun.
It's a really, really good sequence. You know, it's really well orchestrated. And, you know, the kind of G-forces that they're subjecting themselves to doing. He basically says to the robot, if I black out, you have to finish this procedure. You know, I won't be able to do anything. It's really well done. So that's where you see just why he's on this mission. You know, he's not on the mission for his interpersonal skills, which are actually quite poor. he's there because he can get them out of a situation like that where nobody else could really have done that. So they managed to save the ship, but they realize that they've got one more planet to go to, which is the planet Brand originally wanted to go to.
Yeah, I guess they're now looking forward to seeing this this person who's been there.
Yeah, he's hopefully not mad and not going to try and kill them and steal their ship.
Hopefully.
So they devise a plan to slingshot around the black hole, pick up some speed, and then head off to this other planet, which is quite risky. And they get halfway across the black hole, and Cooper, he disengages his ship from the mothership, because the plan has always been for her to get to the planet,
right,
and for him to basically be crushed by the black hole.
Yeah.
So this obviously causes a great deal of consternation. You know, she's very upset about it, but she has no, she can't do anything about it. She can't go back and get him. So he, along with the robot inside the ship, falls into the black hole.
Mm-hmm.
And it's there that, that the film goes into, you know, sort of 2001 type.
Yes. 2001 came to mind very, very much. So, yeah.
Yeah. It, I mean, this film is massively influenced by 2001.
Right.
So as he falls into the black hole, it appears that there's like diamonds and things like this that are battering the ship, which is, I suppose, quite plausible.
By the way, yes. Other Christopher Nolan films have been too long.
Yes.
It sounds like there's been a lot going on.
This one is long, but it has a lot to say.
Right.
It has an awful lot to say, and it says it well. So I didn't find it to be too long. I found the pacing to be good.
Right, but there is a lot of it. From the way you're describing it, there's all kinds of events.
Yes. A lot happens in this film. So he falls into the black hole, and the ship begins to disintegrate around him. And the robot is recording all of this as they fall in. And then he blacks out and he wakes up inside what looks like a massive room. But he's floating. He's floating in space inside this massive room.
Okay. This is like the Matrix 3.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Only
much, much better. Yeah. So he's inside this massive room, and as he's floating around, he looks through what look like walls, and he realizes that he is behind the bookcase in his daughter's bedroom.
Okay. And he's gone back in time?
Well, kind of. What him and the robot figure out is that whatever beings have created this, what is referred to as a tesseract, which I believe is a multi-dimensional cube, they see time. They don't see time as a linear thing. They see time as in the way that we would see a book.
Yeah.
In that they can index it and they can go to any point in it at any time that they... at any point that they want to.
Yeah.
So, and what Cooper realizes is that he has been the person that's been pushing the books off the bookshelves to send messages.
Right.
And so he then has to send the coordinates, otherwise he won't end up actually going. And he's the guy who's pushed the books off the bookshelf in anger at himself leaving his daughter.
Right.
And then he has to send, he realizes that he can send the maths and the physics that will enable the population of planet Earth to actually leave the Earth and come through the wormhole.
Okay. Because where's he got that from?
I can't remember.
All right. It's not important.
I can't remember. But it does work. I mean, the thing with the Tesseract sequence is it's a real stretch.
Yeah.
You know, but and that's where the emotional heart of the film is of benefit, because if it wasn't that way, you probably wouldn't believe it. You wouldn't roll with it.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, that sounds right. But actually, you know, the plot reason for it is strong. He's kind of back with his daughter.
So there is the plot reason for it is solid. So he manages to send all of this information, and then the Tesseract starts to collapse, and he wakes up in the orbit of Saturn, floating in space with the robot.
Okay.
Gets picked up and taken to a space station, a really advanced-looking space station in the orbit of Saturn near the wormhole, and realizes that obviously this is now far into the future because he's been near that black hole for so long that the human race has indeed found a way to make these huge space stations. And somebody arrives at the space station the next day, and that's Murphy.
Yeah.
Who's much older and played by Ellen Burstyn, who was in Requiem for a Dream that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. She was mum. She was the mother
right.
who took the diet pills.
Yeah. So hang on. So that it's not that long. Like has she travelled through time as well, or
no? So she's an elderly lady now.
Okay. So it's only kind of 70 years later or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. She's an elderly lady, and they meet up. And she's got all of her family around her, and he doesn't know any of them. mm-hmm. There's like there's a whole couple of generations of people that he's just not aware of at all. They're not, and they obviously know his face, but it's kind of abstract for them,
yeah,
because he's been absent for so long.
Mm-hmm. I'm on tenterhooks to find out whether she forgives him.
If he forgives them?
No, whether she forgives him.
Yeah, she does. She does, because she knows that without him going through there, that people wouldn't have been saved. So there was a bigger, there's a bigger thing going on.
So did she know that it was him pushing the books until that moment?
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't think so. In fact, I can't actually remember anybody. I can't remember him mentioning whether it was actually him that was doing it.
You would, though, wouldn't you? You'd be like, that was me pushing the books.
That was me.
You know those books? Yeah. That was weird, wasn't it?
It was weird, and it was me. And I'm very sorry it weirded you out. But there was a reason for it. So she then says to him, there's no point in you being here, essentially. You need to get back through the wormhole because, of course, Brand is still alive and on that planet.
Okay.
She made it.
Oh, she's made it, but she's got no way of getting off.
She's got no way of getting off it.
Yeah.
So the final shot of the final sequence of the film is him stealing a ship with the robot, passing through the wormhole, and then the final shot of the film is her on the planet, and then it sort of fades to black, and it's sort of implied that they will get together at the end, which is rather nice.
I see. And he stole the robot. The ship in his sort of old school style.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, flying by the seat of his pants. So I just did Interstellar in like under an hour, which is pretty good. Pretty good.
Yeah, it's a lot of it.
There's a lot of it.
It does sound fun. It sounds like I always felt like 2001, if it just wasn't been so boring, would have been really great.
And yeah, so
doesn't seem boring.
That's a very fair comparison. I think that Interstellar is 2001 with fun bits in.
And a comedy robot.
Well, yeah, I say it's a comedy robot. I think I'm kind of selling it wrongly, actually.
Yeah, no, I'm teasing.
I know. Yeah, so, yeah, 2001 with light-hearted stuff in, I think is fair. Interestingly, there's a Ridley Scott is making an adaptation of a book called The Martian.
Ah, I've heard about that book.
Last year with Matt Damon. And some of the promotional material has got a shot of his face on a poster with the words, "Bring him home." And people have been making an analogy that if it's the same character from Interstellar, you should put in it, "Leave him there." We don't want him coming home. He's mad.
Yeah. Okay, so it's an epic, spacey, actiony thing with lots of relationships and that you care about.
Yes, you care deeply about these people, and the what gives it the beating heart is the family relationship between Cooper and Murphy that transcends the fact that she doesn't know, she had no childhood with him growing up. And that relationship is so strong that all he really wants to do is get back to her. And in the end, they do meet up, which is, a very powerful moment.
That is a relief.
Yeah, it is. It is. So that, mm-hmm. yes, that's Interstellar.
Mm-hmm. And what's the point of it?
What's the point of it?
Is it just a cracking good story?
It is a cracking good story, yeah. But I think the point of it is that... I think that in these days of there being no money for space exploration and sort of people losing the thirst for exploration in space because there's no money and it just doesn't seem like a priority anymore. This kind of makes you think that we should be doing it and we should be kind of spending the money to do it because as we've seen just today and yesterday with these amazing pictures from Pluto that have been coming back, there is wonder and awe in that, just in our solar system.
Yeah, and I wonder, I think that there are a lot of people around who wish that we hadn't stopped exploring space, and I think films set in space are part of a kind of movement of people saying, look, we should be doing this.
I mean, I think it's amazing that the more we learn about space, the weirder and stranger it gets. I mean, there was a... on close examination of Mercury, they found ice caps on Mercury.
That is surprising.
Which is so close to the sun, you wouldn't expect them to be there, but it's just incredible. That is mind-boggling. Really is amazing. So... I think that the New Horizons probe to Pluto just shows that we can't stop looking. We've got to keep exploring and finding out what is out there, because you learn. Okay, so to sum up, Interstellar teaches us how amazing the human race can be when we work together.
If we just remember to push the books.
Yeah, exactly.
You should always, if you ever find yourself in a tesseract and you can see your daughter through the bookshelf, you should always push the books.
Push the books. In fact, maybe that should be a t-shirt. Push the books.
Push them.
Push them.
Yeah.
So, that's the point of it.
So someone said to me, I wouldn't be able to stand it because the science is too annoying.
But okay, I
don't think I'll be bothered by that. I mean, obviously, I sounded bothered by it during this podcast, so perhaps I'm wrong.
I would. Sorry, I would. I'm just going to mute it for a moment. I would encourage, people who listen to this podcast who haven't seen the film, and maybe if they have seen the film and they haven't really gotten into the sort of the nitty gritty of it, to seek out the science of it, because Kip Thorne was tasked with coming up with science that was solid for the film. You know, Christopher Nolan said, I want the science to be solid until the point when we need to tell the story, and then we might have to deviate from it slightly.
Yeah.
But I want it to be solid. I don't want this to be like a science fiction fanciful type of thing. I want it to be scientifically sound.
The thing about the Tesseract is fine by me, you know, that kind of magical stuff, as we've mentioned, it happens in a lot of things, and that's fine. The thing about the time shifting, maybe I'm wrong, it sounds to me ridiculous. Like, if you were in that amount of gravity, you'd be torn apart. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe because this planet's rotating very fast or something, then it works. I don't know.
So,
rotating around the black hole very fast, but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I had to look at the sort of like him talking about the science of Gargantua in the film. And what he talks about is that it's not very fast moving, so it doesn't have these problems with the gravitational field sort of tearing things apart.
Okay.
I mean, you probably understand this stuff better than I do, and certainly probably be able to communicate it better than I can, which is not very well. But in terms of the movie, in terms of how it works in the movie, it's I didn't find it to be annoying. I found it that it serviced the plot.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is the point. The whole point is that they lose all this time, and that is a great plot element. Very interesting.
It's amazing.
So I don't think it would spoil it for me, even if I thought it didn't add up. It's just I'm interested in that because someone said to me that they didn't like it for that reason. But
okay. No, I think some people have found it to be irritating. I didn't personally find it to be irritating. I took my son to see it at the cinema, and he obviously probably didn't fully understand it. Maybe I didn't either, but we both really enjoyed the adventure and excitement of it and the pioneering spirit of the whole thing.
So what certificate is it?
I think it's either a PG or a 12A.
Right. Okay, so it's very
it's
family friendly.
There are scary moments. I think the scene where Matt Damon's character attacks Cooper is quite scary, but it's not overly threatening, you know. It's not a 15, you know, it's a 12A or a PG.
Mm-hmm. It does sound really good. It sounds like there's just a lot to keep you interested and a lot of fun stuff going on.
The other thing that's interesting is that we probably need to wrap up soon, but the other thing that's very interesting is they used a lot of practical effects in the film.
Yeah,
so
love that.
The shuttles are, you know, obviously they don't fly, but they are real. You know, that they sit in them, and it's a real shuttle that they built for this thing. And the actual revolving ship, all of that was built for real, so they can navigate around it and walk around inside it and that kind of thing. And in actual fact, the actual CG in the film is about the same as something like, say, one of his Dark Knight movies. So lots and lots of practical effects. And the depiction of Gargantua with a black hole and the strange, weird-looking planets are very, very effective. And even the stuff on Earth with the Dust Bowl and the crops dying and stuff like that. It's all beautifully. I should actually talk about. He shot a lot of this film on IMAX cameras.
Okay.
Which are, I think they're 72 millimeter film cameras, which are big negatives.
Right, and they're wide angle, right, as well.
I think no, it's not. It's not that wide. It's okay. I think it's like the same widescreen as normal that we have on TV.
Okay.
So I watched it at home on my projector. I watched the IMAX Blu-ray. So it switches aspect ratio between the, you know, the 2.35 letterboxed widescreen to full frame IMAX. And when it goes full frame IMAX, you can see the difference in the clarity of the image.
Right.
It's really, really beautiful. And as a sort of point of interest about IMAX, I think Ari, who are a camera maker, have developed a digital IMAX system that has basically made the camera much smaller and easier to handle. Because at the moment, they're huge, great, noisy cameras that are quite unwieldy. But they've developed a digital IMAX system that you can use like you would use a normal camera. So I'm looking forward to seeing more stuff shot in IMAX because the format is just amazing. It's fantastic.
Cool. Speaking of the practical effects, did you see the way they did the, you know, this in Inception, you know, the bit where they're in the office and the gravity's shifting?
Yes.
I saw, I don't know whether it was on the DVD or somewhere else, they used a massive gantry thing and they actually rotated it round to get the gravity changes. And that's all just physical effects. It's absolutely amazing. And that's why it looks so good.
So I didn't catch some of that. How did they change the...
The whole set is just on a massive crane, and they actually rotate it. It's incredible.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it makes for a brilliant
effect. Christopher Nolan is very fond of his practical effects, and I think that as with, you know, the antithesis of that is the latest Jurassic World, right. where there's far too much CG, there's not enough practical. And people have said that they thought the velociraptors were better in Jurassic Park than they are in Jurassic World. And I think that's true.
They are scary.
Because there was more practical. There was a good mix of practical and CG in Jurassic Park. And that's yeah, what makes it scary. Yeah.
There were a lot of sort of rubber, like dinosaur tails and things in Jurassic Park, weren't there?
Yeah.
Getting waved around by a props guy.
And although Jurassic World is entertaining and fun, it's not as good a movie as Jurassic Park, which is very interesting.
Well, that I think that completes our podcast on Jurassic World.
I think it does.
We don't need to do that.
I don't think we need to do anything else about that, no. No, cool. I could probably talk for about half an hour about the female gender politics of the film, but I'm not going to.
We'll save that. I'll choose a better film to speak about gender politics.
Yes, definitely. One that actually has some.
Cool. All right, well, thank you very much.
Thank you. We're taking a break for a few weeks, is that right?
Yes, we'll be taking a break basically till after the summer probably, but we've got loads of ideas of other things to do, and we're looking forward to doing them. We won't say what we're going to do because we've got no idea.
I think we would actually. I think it was Fozzie's idea about Nightcrawler. I think it may have been, but we would be interested in hearing what people.
No, it wasn't Fozzie. Someone else.
Was somebody else?
Yeah.
I think we'd be interested to hear if people have any suggestions for films that we could talk about.
Absolutely.
Especially stuff that I haven't seen, that I could go and watch it and then we could talk about it.
Yeah, and I could avoid. That's not that hard for me.
Sorry, I didn't catch that.
I said I could avoid, I have to avoid watching it. That's
yes.
All. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. But I think you'd really enjoy Interstellar.
Yeah, well, I'm allowed to watch it now. And I think I will.
Good.
Cool.
Okay.
See you next time. Thanks.
Yeah, see you. Thank you.